Good afternoon and welcome to the Sitka Nature Show. This is your host, Matt. I want to thank you for joining me here in the first weekend of December 2020. It's been a rough start to December this year with a series of storms moving through with just short breaks in between, strong winds and heavy rains here in Sitka, and even heavier rains elsewhere in Southeast Alaska, I know. One of these storm systems that brought 32-foot seas to the Cape Edgecumbudia out offshore also brought a lot of those waves were coming into the Sound, and I had no interest in going out in the Sound in a boat, but it was interesting to go out to Sandy Beach and see the waves coming in there and see the waves out a little further crashing against some of those rocks out there, as well as checking out from the bridge Fitzgerry Island, and even 7 miles away you could see the tall waves splashing up off as they broke across the rocks there. If you've been getting out, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. The conversation I have for this week's show is one I recorded yesterday with local Sitkan Roland Wirth. Roland is an active outdoorsman who has explored much of the area around Sitka, both on foot and by kayak. We talked about our mutual interest in understanding the natural history of the Sitka area, as well as some of the projects he's been involved with, including mapping, making maps of the Sitka area. So go ahead and join the conversation with him, talking a little bit about what brought him to Sitka.
I've been here now almost 31 years in January. It'll be 31. And I initially came to Sitka to run the Raven's Way wilderness programming. Raven's Way is a treatment program for adolescents from around the state with drug and alcohol issues. And I had been doing that a lot down south, specializing in wilderness therapy. So doing outdoor leadership as a wilderness therapist. I don't have a counseling degree, but kind of relying on the wilderness experience to be healing and processing that. So a lot of training in that realm. So I came here for in theory, spending a maximum of 2 years here because I didn't think I could survive being in a rainforest this far north. But I fell in love with both the nature, the wildness around Sitka, and the community. So here we are almost 31 years later, and we will be here the rest of our lives. It's a beautiful spot. It's surprisingly rich in resources for people that love the outdoors.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm sure there are many, many stories of we came for a couple of years and 30 years later, we're still here. My parents had a similar story. They came to SJ for a couple of years and ended up being here for the better part of 30 before moving back south when family needs pulled them back. Interesting. I know some folks that do wilderness therapy stuff, and it seems like it can be a really powerful way to help folks kind of find themselves again when they maybe have gotten lost in some things that are challenging.
Yeah, and I was just going to add a few interesting things that come up here. I guess the first thing is you know, I believe, you know, we all come from ancestries that live very closely intertwined with the natural world. And so I think just it's natural, instinctive that an outdoor experience can be very positive, very healing for everybody. But the one condition is it has to be a fairly positive experience. Obviously, you can't have something that's extremely scary, you know, life-threatening. You have to be fairly comfortable or come out of it in a success mode. And that was a challenge here. It's kind of interesting to note with all the rain we're having lately is, you know, how do you have that positive experience? So we were constantly challenged this time of year when we're on a, you know, three-week expedition, which we tried to do even this time of year back then. How do you make it positive each day when it's raining nonstop being out there? Wilderness can be great and healing, but we also need to figure out how to tweak it a little bit when this weather comes in.
Yeah, it has been a little damp and dreary in some ways, and windy actually, a little unsafe in the forests in some places due to trees falling and branches falling. And I did, it is interesting, you know, I guess the first time I actually heard of you was through, I know you worked at SJ for a while. I don't know how many years, but I had moved away for college mostly, but I know my brother took a class or two from you, and my parents knew you. So you're doing survival skills outdoor classes there at the college. And so how did that? I guess you must have probably brought that sensibility a little bit into the work there in terms of bringing people out. In that case, college students, and helping them understand what it. I guess part of it's just like, how do we show up in order to maximize our chances of having a good time that isn't, that's a thrival time instead of a survival time, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the college, it was fun to make that transition. I had been involved in wilderness therapy for about 9 years in total. Started way back in New Jersey. Only place I've really been chased by a bear, which is kind of cool to talk about, you know, New Jersey having wild bear and one chasing me. After 9 years of doing that, and kind of like we shared a little earlier, the Raven's Way job kind of came to a close for me, and I knew I wanted to stay in Sitka at that time. And then at the same time, Sheldon Jackson College had an opening for teaching a few classes in outdoor recreation, outdoor education. And I then kind of had fostered the dream of, well, let's see if we can get an accredited outdoor program going there. So that I started a master's study that would be that, helping design a outdoor program there. And I really enjoyed it. I mean, again, a lot of it is teaching people skills. They're more comfortable and safer in the outdoors, so they can enjoy it. So it is healthy and therapeutic. And then, you know, is teaching young, you know, new leaders, the students, kind of sharing with them what that healing benefit can be in the outdoors, you know, and how it can build a better person. It was kind of a natural continuation of what I was doing before.
Well, I imagine it's different when, yeah, as I think about it, you know, what I would do going out versus what I would do if I felt responsible for others while I was going out. And it feels like there's kind of a different dynamic, because part of it's I feel a sense of control in a sense over my own comfort. I have the ability to, I know my limits, so to speak. Like if it's going to be pouring down rain, I know I can deal with that or not, because I've been through it before. But you don't always know that with other people, and you don't always know how they're going to respond to, or even what things they might perceive as being threatening. Some folks are, you know, the dark in the woods is a pretty a bad time, and other folks it might be cold or the bears, wild animals, any number of things, I suppose. And then there are things that are just like, they're just dangerous no matter how you slice it. They're risky, and you know, sometimes that could be stream crossings or the threat of hypothermia here. So I like to tell people, I says, well, Alaska, at least where I live in Alaska, it's not subtle about its threats. You know, it's there's bears and there's the weather and the terrain, and those are pretty much, including in the terrain, I'll include the ocean. And those are pretty much the threats. Beyond that, you know, you don't have the little bugs or critters that can get into your shoes and bite you or any of those sorts of things. It's all pretty obvious there, but I, you know, with my experience, I feel pretty comfortable doing the things that I do, but I don't know about how that translates to bringing others out. So I imagine that was part of what, when you're working with people in an outdoor leadership kind of setting and training them to be taking others out, that's a part of what you need to kind of be aware of and helping people understand how to work with.
Yeah, exactly. And you hit on a good point. Being an outdoor leader, especially, well, in any environment, almost, you're constantly in the back of your head, you're having this thought of, wow, are we safe? You know, are we? And you realize that you're more concerned because of that group that's with you than your own feelings. You know, you might be fine personally, but you know, it starts getting dark and you're still on the trail. You haven't met your campsite goal or whatever, and it will feel a little more stressful with the group just simply because you don't have control over the group as much, and you don't know how people are doing. So there's all those elements in leadership that create a heightened sense of awareness there of conditions of a storm coming over the ridge or whatever. And all of that encourages, fosters the importance of really good communication. So, you know, it then becomes communication is a key in the outdoors. And unfortunately, you know, it seems like the outdoors, whenever a group goes hiking, I mean, friends or whoever, it tends to foster a lot of really healthy communication. It tends to be a release. It's a time for sharing, you know. So it tends to, you know, tighten bonds and, you know, with good leadership, which I don't even think is necessarily that hard because the outdoors does so much of the work. But as long as you can help, you know, foster that environment for that to happen, it will create a really tight-knit group and people will feel comfortable expressing that they're afraid or uncomfortable with the situation. And then that spills over into, you know, just the social dynamics in the group when people feel like, you know, some expression was hurtful or whatever. So, you know, it then, you know, you can process it all to whatever level that applies to every life situation, which is fun. But it is exactly as you said, it's that trying to sense a group. So it makes you want to be more sensitive to each other that way about, you know, concerns about the physical challenges, but then it branches into the emotional, spiritual, mental challenges as well, which is the cool part.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. It is. I had an experience on not this year, but last year, 2019, just having a week as kind of a guest naturalist on a cruise ship, one of the smaller cruise ships. And they were a company that emphasized really getting people out and having experiences out. And so, you know, you're bringing people together for a week that have very different levels of experience and background. And one of the things that I've come to understand here is we don't all mean the same thing when we say backcountry or off trail or even trail for that matter.
Exactly.
And it's one of the things that I guess I started developing a little bit of an awareness of when I first put up some stuff about trails on my website back in probably 98 or 99, something like that. And I was kind of thinking about that and I was like, well, okay, so there's all the trails and there's the trail guide and stuff. So I felt pretty comfortable with that. But when it came to kind of backcountry stuff, and this of course was before the days of Gaia GPS, you know, there were some handheld GPS things that you could use, but having tracks and sharing those over the internet was not nearly as easy as it is now. So I literally took a scan of a topographical map and drew in basically the equivalent of a Sharpie, but I was doing it on my computer, just kind of a rough thing for some of these routes, not at all intending it to be something that somebody would try and follow in any kind of precise way. But, and then just made a note, you know, like this was really terrible. I would never recommend anybody do this. You know, we made it, but, or this wasn't too bad, but also just realizing that people aren't necessarily going to understand what it's like here and if they haven't been out. And since then, I've talked to folks that are like, yeah, I took somebody out. And they say, oh, yeah, I'm used to doing backcountry stuff. And we got out and they're like, well, we mean very different things by backcountry.
Exactly.
Some of the steep and brushy stuff here. And so it is an interesting thing to just consider, you know, both when you're out with people or proposing to go out with people, you know, if you don't know their background and how to communicate clearly. I think that's an interesting challenge so that we're all on the same page. And I noticed one of the things that the cruise company did is they, as the week went on, that they allowed people to, because people are paying a lot of money to come on this cruise and they don't necessarily want to be told what to do. So there's an art to sort of helping people understand what is a good fit for them. So the early stuff, they would talk up some of it as being kind of difficult. But folks that wanted to try it, you know, they would do it, but it wasn't really very difficult. And the folks that were already struggling with that then would sort of start to filter out. And as the week went on, the difficult things were actually became more of an actual bushwhack. For example, there was, I went out with one and we literally just went up and over a hill. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, this is not the way I would go up and over this hill.
Yeah.
And then I reflected on it, I realized, but I would be going because I was trying to get somewhere. And they were going because they were, you know, the guides from the company were leading for an experience. They were hoping to facilitate an experience. That was their goal. They weren't trying to get anywhere in particular. Mm-hmm. It was really about the experience of going. So for them, the more full bodied sort of bushwhack of like climbing through stuff and a little bit of brush and, you know, climbing under trees that had fallen over or whatever, all that stuff that is annoying to me as a hiker trying to get somewhere.
For them, that's that three-dimensional experience of the woods. Yeah. And, you know, there was no destination other than getting back to the beach and then back on the boat in a couple of hours. So it was interesting for me to just kind of reflect on that a little bit and my own, you know, differing priorities. Like I have plenty of experience of that kind of stuff where, you know, that's just where you have to go to get where you want to go and, and where I want to go is more of interest. So that in and of itself didn't really interest me personally, but being with those folks and seeing how they were enjoying it and like, this is they're in this rainforest and in this very different habitat than they've been in before and really kind of thrashing around to kind of get through stuff, climbing up a steep hill. It's a little bit muddy and they were having a lot of fun. So it was, of course they had the boat to look forward to and the nice dinner and all of that in the evening. So, that helps as well when there's a short time window, but it was very interesting. I enjoyed talking with the folks out there and hearing some of their experiences and just seeing them experience Southeast Alaska in a way that it's easy for me to kind of take for granted. And so, because I've been here for so long, so I appreciated the sight of newness of the eyes, so to speak, you know, and my ability to, through them, kind of take on a little bit of that newness, sensibility.
Yeah, it's so neat to hear you've had that experience too, just to be aware of that. And there's a richness there and just, you know, people in the outdoors, I feel like that's the best combination there is. And, you know, as far as ruggedness, yes, Alaska is so different. I mean, Alaska is even different from itself from north to south by extremes. But, you know, I grew up in Maine and was always very active in the outdoors in Maine, doing solo backpacking trips and, you know, off trail. But, you know, Alaska in general is very raw and rugged. And when I go back to Maine now, it feels very tame and comfortable, you know, temperatures and all kinds of things, less drastic weather. So here it is especially a significant challenge for a lot of people that are new to it. And then what I was saying about as you're talking too, the beauty of being in social groups in the outdoors is I think there's this natural thing of just this confidence. Everybody, right, feels like they're very competent in the outdoors, and then we get slapped back a little bit at times here and there. But I think the fun part, a lot of humor comes with that, because no matter who you are, you're going to trip, you're going to fall, you're going to get at least temporarily disoriented or lost. There's these very humbling reminders for the outdoors. And, you know, the example of kayaking out in the Gulf right here, Sitka Sound, or if you paddle out a little further, do the outside of Kruzov or Chichikov. I mean, we're just a tiny little cork in this huge ocean, and the wilderness here is kind of the same. It's so big and raw. So it makes us feel small. And for some reason, I haven't quite figured out, but humans seem to like feeling small in that context. There's something neat about that. At least I feel it, and it seems others do too. So, yeah, a lot of qualities there, all intertwined.
Yeah, it does. I think it seems to offer a sense of perspective that allows us to, you know, we get so caught up in some of the day-to-day stuff, and it feels so big in the moment, and sometimes. Mm-hmm. Seeing how small we are allows us to like, okay, wait a minute. I don't necessarily need to make a mountain out of this molehill.
Right.
There's some big stuff out there, and you know, just the technology that we have these days, like the buoy that's out there, the Cape Edgecombe buoy. And I like to check that each day, and now they have a camera on it, so you can actually see the waves. It's not quite as intense looking most of the time. Even when there's sometimes 20 plus foot seas out there, you can hardly tell because of the way that the camera is. But it is kind of interesting to look at that and see, like recently in these windstorms we had, there were 32 foot seas. And I think that 32 feet is the two thirds of the waves are. So one third of the waves are actually even bigger than that.
Wow.
And so it is. It's something that I would have no desire whatsoever to be out in a boat. But if there was some way of sort of being there in a bubble suspended above and just sort of like, wow, this is pretty intense. Or maybe someday anticipating that kind of weather and either going south of town to one of those exposed capes or out on cruise off and setting up, you know, in the calm, and then being there to see those waves crashing into those exposed capes on the outer coast. And I just, I'd be really interested to see what that's like. And maybe I don't even like, maybe it's super intense and it would be terrifying. I don't know, but it is something that I thought would be kind of cool to witness.
Well, I finally found a partner to do that with, I guess, because I've always had that dream, and probably would be kayaking down there or something, just because you can't leave a boat there or you'd have to be dropped off with a storm like that coming in. But yeah, if you look at the cliffs down south, you know, Bjork area, I mean, it's 50 foot up or more that these cliffs are swept, you know, bare rock. And it must be incredible to watch. There, a few of us have talked about, maybe we'll have a petition going now to ask the Coast Guard to install a little model boat out at the buoy. So that will show up in the camera. It'd be kind of cool for getting the perspective on the size of those waves.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, it is. I think part of it is just that you can't see the horizon sometimes. And so your yeah. judgment of like how steep they are is just hard to know. And I guess the buoys are actually probably tilting as well. But yeah, it would be interesting. I figured, yeah, probably it's anchor up in a protected bay or better yet, get dropped off and picked up a few days later for one of those kind of things, and then find your spot. But yeah, maybe someday. And yeah. It is kind of interesting. So when you've been doing the outdoor survival stuff and that kind of thing, do you, like, I know, for example, with lighting fires, this is not the easiest country for fire lighting. And I tended to take that for granted. And somebody, you know, looked at me and said some harsh words when I like had my fire stick and I just set it beside me, down south where like fires are a thing. Right. So I never even considered that, you know, you could be risking starting a forest fire by doing something like that because it's so wet here. But do you, and we don't have that many different woods, but I know different woods burn differently. And is that something that you've experimented with over the years to figure out what's a good way to get a fire started in these wet conditions?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that too, because actually I just ran into an old SJ student working on a project here with trail work stuff. And she was a student at SJ, took my outdoor survival class. And fire is one of the parts of survival, the seven steps of survival. I used to teach that with the Coast Guard as well. And fire, I believe, is the last step because it's kind of on the edge of play there. It's not, you don't want to depend on it because it can be very challenging here to get a fire going. And you know, ultimately you want to work on your own personal shelter through clothing and building some kind of mossy little den to crawl into. But fire comes along as, you know, an important step to survival because you can prepare food with it. It's just spiritually warming. It's going to give you this hope and will to live. But it's so challenging here. What I've found is, and you're going to have to help me here because I used to hear it called, Rusty Menzesia, the azalea plant, the false azalea.
Yeah, false azalea.
False azalea, and you can maybe Latin name. Do you remember that?
Well, it's changed. It's now, it used to be Menzesia ferruginea, but now I believe it's considered a rhododendron. So rhododendron Menzesia.
Oh, really?
I believe
it's the rhododendron. Oh, neat. That is the key here for getting a fire going. So if you can find standing dead wood of that plant, it is a hardwood in my mind. It's very hard, dry, brittle stuff. And even after it's been raining like this, if you can find standing dead, you might even with a pocket knife trim off the outside. But then you will be able to split it and you can light it with a lighter and you'll get a nice hot flame going with that wood alone. I've cooked meals on it before in the survival situation when I used to teach survival, you know, would get limpets and things off the beach. And that is the key. Obviously, there's sapwoods and things like that, but that's become my standby for getting the fire going, you know, it's small anyway. And then if you have cedar around, especially dry cedar or something like that. But yeah. That's my one big key that if people want to go and figure out which plant that is, it's an understory brush, can get quite big. And there's always seemingly quite a bit of dead stuff around when it is growing in an area. So, and it stays dry. It doesn't rot very readily, I don't think. So anyway, give it a try yourself if you haven't yet, and I want to hear about it.
It's one of those things where I suppose that there's a real value in kind of playing really with some of these things and just trying it for fun while you're out, and it doesn't really matter. You're not depending on it.
Yeah.
So that when you are depending on it, you have the experience and ability to kind of do those things. I know that my brother ended up doing a program at the Wilderness Awareness School. It was an immersion program for a year. And one of the things that they would do, I think, during their outings was they would have 5-minute fire drills, basically, where it was like, okay, gather up the stuff and see if you can get a fire going in 5 minutes. And this was in Western Washington. So in the wintertime, fairly wet, maybe not quite as wet as here, but definitely wet country. So
yeah, that's impressive.
Those are the sorts of things that they would try, and there would be a team of them. So there would be, you know, they would divide duties, you know, getting tinder, kindling, or those sorts of things. And I don't know if they were trying, they might've even had a bow drill kit with them. So they might've been trying to do it with bow drill friction fires. They would have been carrying those kits with them.
Yeah. And interestingly, right before I came up here, I was working in Idaho, actually with a survival school down there. We got quite a few students from Alaska, Alaskan natives, came down there for the program, and I was always so impressed with the awareness of the natural world that they had, you know, so that they were very quick to acquire the skills. But we were, you know, trying to replicate some of the skills of the Paiute Indian of that area of Idaho, and teaching the students that to survive. So it was a very different kind of course instead of an Outward Bound styled course where you have tents, sleep mags, stoves. This was all relying, you know, we had a wool blanket and we had about 1,000 calories of food a day to eat. But we had to forge everything else. We had to make all our own fires. And we started off with flint and steel, but then everybody after the first week had to master bow drill fires. And there, obviously, with the dry country and sage and cottonwood, we could both get bow drill and hand drill fires going. And, you know, we used to have races and we could get this. We did the smallest bow drill set. You know, these were little tiny miniature sized bow drill sets, and we'd make natural cordage for the, so it was all natural materials. And then we'd have the speed. And I remember we could get flames in 30 seconds with a bow drill fire set, you know, kind of thing. And, you know, everybody could acquire that. It's just practice, like a lot of things, but it's also how dry are your materials in there? Everything's bone dry. So it was quite a shock coming here after that. And I was knocked off balance just by this environment in a big way after having worked in the high desert for quite a while. This was quite the opposite. So it was a big adjustment.
Yeah. Yeah. Different risks, certainly with fire or without fire there. I mean, you have to be concerned about fire spreading in some times a year for sure. And probably don't have fires at all due to that here. Not so much of an issue, but getting the fire started in the first place certainly can be a little bit challenging. And I imagine the beach is a pretty easy place to find some calories around here, not so available in the desert, perhaps, although there maybe is more plant foods and I suppose small animals, rodents and rabbits and, you know, up to that size that maybe are available for the person that knows how to acquire them.
Right. Yeah. Down there, we did eat a lot of small rodents. We learned to set up little Paiute deadfall traps each night. You'd put a little couple grains in there or whatever, a flat rock resting on a trigger stick, you know, with cordage. And in the morning, you'd find a flattened mouse, and it was kind of fun. The students that were new sometimes used too big of a rock, so the mouse was really flat. And then you'd cook it over a early morning fire, you know, and after really quick gutting and skinning, you'd have this one, you know, two bite maybe, bones and all. And they were good. They were like a crunchy steak, you know, crispy steak because the bones were so small. So that was, you know, a significant part of our daily intake. We ate snake and occasionally a marmot, porcupine. It was kind of anything we could find. And then, yeah, a lot of plants, roots and things like that. But everybody got thinner, you know, it's definitely a good diet for weight loss. You know, we were hiking probably averaging, you know, 8 to 10 miles a day too, and tracking animals, all kinds of things. That was neat. But, and then, yeah, you're very right. Coming up here, the whole, you know, the table is set when the tide is out is a great mantra to remember. If you were ever in a survival situation, if you're at all near the coast, get near the coast so that you can daily go out and forage at low tide. And, you know, there's, in most areas, there's very plentiful food. I noticed in traveling around the world some that, our, you know, North Pacific is very, very rich in intertidal. I guess I was thinking off of the coast of Spain, you know, there are areas that was hardly anything. And I can't make it out. You know, it was almost seemed so unnatural. There's very little, you know, seaweed, algae, just seemed barren at times. And I wondered, could it be pollution or what's going on? But maybe you have some information on that. But this area is incredibly rich, intertidal and below tidal probably too for divers. It just seems very, very rich. Do you have any knowledge as to what contributes to that here?
I think the cold water and the nutrient rich water is my understanding is big contributing factors.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it is. I mean, in summary, we are very blessed here with that. If you ever get into the situation where you're hungry and you're on the coast, there's a lot of opportunity there. You shouldn't go hungry.
Yeah. Well, and I know that we mentioned at the very beginning that iNaturalist is a place that we run into each other a little bit. And so it's something that I've been involved in for a little while, and you've been involved in for at least, well, I think you started kind of mostly in our All Species Community Big Year project in 2017 and have really continued to use it since then. And so it's always fun to see where, what you're finding and where you've been. I guess somebody said, are you a little bit of a stalker of people on iNaturalist? So not intentionally, but I am, but it does work out that way because I check it so often. I get to see where people have been exploring around.
Yeah.
And what got you into all of that end of things?
Well, I guess I should start from, I've always loved the outdoors. I've always been into like watching insects and this and that since I was a kid. So curiosity about nature has always been part of my life. And my family fostered that, I suppose, in the environment I grew up in. And then it continued to grow through my work in the outdoors with people. You know, it was a great way to share that. I have a degree in biology. I thought I'd go into more of a, you know, ecological studies, wildlife ecology, things like that. But, you know, life took me down a different path. I ended up starting doing this outdoor program in New Jersey of all places and realized there's amazing outdoor experiences there. And, you know, find myself in Sitka and loving the outdoors here and then meeting you and hearing about iNaturalist. Just to me, that was like the perfect fit because I think at that time too, I was starting to keep a list of species that I observed on the 1 acre island we leased from the Russian Orthodox Church where we built a home. And I just thought it was fascinating, you know, this roughly 1 acre island and, you know, we have bird life and plant life, and then there's all the intertidal life surrounding it. And it's very rich. The diversity is amazing for the same reason Sitka is amazing for the diversity, because we have all these edge environments, you know, muskegon forest and alpine and marine. Anyways, you told me about iNaturalist. I just instantly knew that it was a perfect fit for my interest. And if anything, I need to figure out a way to scale it back. I love the outdoor hiking, exploring, taking photos of things. And then I do enjoy trying to figure out what they are on the computer with iNaturalist. It's a beautiful kind of experientially tied way of learning more about your surroundings, which I'm definitely into. But it does take time, and the computer time's harder for me always, you know, so I feel like I always want to study things more, and maybe that will be the goal next year, just to take less pictures, go for the deeper learning of really learning about a few species more intensely. But yeah, it's constantly, a, it's it fills in, for me, iNaturalist fills in any possible gaps. You know, when you're out hiking, rather than just hiking, you're constantly looking for something new. And that, for me, that's like brings out the kid in me, you know, of just curiosity about the world, right? It's when we assume we know everything that life gets maybe a little boring. Well, if you're constantly looking for something new, life is a treasure hunt. And who doesn't like a treasure hunt? So iNaturalist is great that way. And again, thank you, Matt, for getting me into it. And thank you for your patience in gently correcting me on my identifications recently, calling some high-flying swans some cranes. And I'm learning the difference in those now. Those are over the island. So I was saying, all right, I got a new crane species for the island, but not yet. But yeah, I mean, iNaturalist, what, in Sitka, you've helped lead Sitkins to, what, we have half the observations for the whole state or something like that, you were saying, right?
Yeah, I think it's not quite that high now as more people in other places in the state. But I think, yeah, it's something like a third or maybe even 40% of the statewide observations are from Sitka area.
Wow, it's great. I mean, and you are, I mean, you're helping so many people learn, you know, it's a very gentle process, right? We all get the, what do you call it? It's not facial recognition, but when we post pictures, the computers help you identify what it likely could be, you know, at least in possibilities. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes the computers fail, and that's when you come in and others, but you're doing so much of that, of helping people learn what species we're looking at, which is really cool. I mean, you know, we've talked about it before, to key out species or to constantly hit the bird book, it's challenging. It's hard. So between the computer identification and then folks like you identifying, it's a great process for anyone who loves the outdoors to learn more about it. It just turns into fun, experiential treasure hunt is my best way of describing it.
Yeah, it is something that sort of hits the sweet spot for me as well in terms of how I like to do things. My numbers are something that I don't get too obsessive over, but I do find them motivating. So earlier this year, my quest was to get to 2,000 species, and that's 2,000 things identified to species. Wow. So I passed that. And for me, I mean, that was in Southeast Alaska and Sitka more specifically. I have a few things outside of Sitka, but
that's,
I don't have any
impressive
observations.
Number.
Yeah, it's quite a few. I suspect that it's not even close to half of what a person could theoretically get. But it is, one thing I was just talking to my son the other day about it. And one thing I've come to realize is that, you know, for example, I tried three different times with varying degrees of effort to get to 1,000 species in a year.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until 2017 that I surpassed that the first time. And wow. Since that year, every year since, I've gotten over 1,000 taxa, in a year. And it's just by doing what I've been doing without any particular, effort towards it. And I think what's going on, well, one is I've started to use iNaturalist more, but the other is that once you kind of know the stuff, when you know what's here, the hard part's getting the ID in the first place. And then once you know what's here, it's relatively easy. You kind of have a sense of it. And mm-hmm. So it's a little easier to find stuff. And that is one of the things that you mentioned, that you have the sense that, or you just end up with the feeling, well, I know what's here. And growing up here, yeah. I think I felt that way. One of the things I've noticed as an adult being much more interested in natural history was all the things that I never knew I didn't know
right.
as a kid,
right.
where I would have been like, I was out and around, and, you know, red-breasted sapsuckers being one of the big things for me. The first one I remember seeing, I was in high school, so it was before I started getting really into natural history stuff. But I remember walking home, actually it was from my senior class party, early in the morning, and seeing what I now know is a red-breasted sapsucker. At the time, it was a woodpecker to me. And so I remember seeing one of those. And now I understand that they're really common and they're on every utility pole. And I almost certainly had to have walked by many of them and many nests of them over the time that I was growing up and just had no awareness whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And it's a little disconcerting in some ways, because it's like, well, how much am I missing now that I just have no no idea whatsoever.
Right.
No sense of what could be here. And so part of that is that quest to see with, it's an interesting trade-off, right? Because the new eyes, sometimes you see things that you've been overlooking. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the nice things about having folks that ask questions, like they don't know what is around, and or sometimes the specialists come in that know, you know, they don't know everything, but they know a lot about a particular group. And so they can help find things that I just had never noticed. But then also having the experience to be able to kind of filter and recognize something as being different. And so it's an interesting dynamic, and iNaturalist is really helpful in sort of providing a lot of different eyes that are looking. And so sometimes people, both on the identification side and on the observation side. And so it's really been a help for me in terms of my own interests in getting more species. And so like my son started getting into turning over logs and pieces of bark on the forest floor and finding all sorts of terrestrial arthropods, invertebrates of various sorts, including some interesting millipedes and that kind of thing. So like that wasn't an area I had been looking. It was kind of a blind spot in a way. It's like, I guess theoretically I knew I could look there, but I imagined that there probably wasn't really that much different there because I'd turned over a log once or twice and hadn't seen much.
Yeah. Well, and that's where we need more people involved in this, because they're all going to have different interests. And tell us a little more about I forget the numbers, but you've had a great year of observing the different moss species in Sitka. I can't remember. Share with us.
Oh, yeah. Mosses are...
Oh, moth. Moth. I'm
oh,
sorry.
Moth. Yeah, moth. Yeah, moths are... I set up a little black light, a UV light on my porch. And a porch light. So over the summer, I had a sheet and a UV light plus the porch light that I would just leave on at night. And then each evening, pretty much almost every evening before I went to bed, I would go out and see what was out. And then when I got up in the morning, not always very early, I would see what was still there. And as the day went on, things would tend to fly away. So the earlier I got up, the more I would find. But most of what I was able to photograph, it would have been in the evenings. And then some additional things that showed up overnight and didn't fly away before I got up in the morning. And I don't remember how many different species I've got of moths this year, but probably over 100 different ones. It's one of those things that I started doing a few years ago. My daughter actually was finding moths, and I was surprised at how many she was finding. And then she showed me that she was finding them. This is when we lived on behind the SJ Museum. And she would go around, and the SJ Museum, Sheldon Jackson Museum, has lights that are on overnight. Mm-hmm. And she would find them by the lights. And mm-hmm. So like, I don't know why it had never occurred to me that they would be there, but they it hadn't. And so when she was doing that, she would bring some to me, and then that was kind of what got me started looking for moths around the lights, especially as I was trying to get more species and, you know, do 1,000 species in a year and those yeah. sorts of things. So it's been, and they're challenging. Some of them are pretty easy, but there's some that are pretty difficult. And again, part of the hard part is getting a name on them in the first place.
Right.
And once you kind of get the name on them, then you're like, okay, I can recognize these. But yeah, getting the first name, getting an ID the first time is often the most difficult part. And that's, iNaturalist is helpful for that, because there are some folks that mm-hmm. specialize in different groups that can then help get those names on to start with.
So iNaturalist right now says 170 species of moth here in Sitka. Is that
in Sitka?
Or is that taxa maybe?
That's probably, I mean, I would almost certainly there are more species than that here.
Yeah, but that's impressive.
And almost certainly some of those species that are in that 170 aren't here.
Yeah.
would be my guess.
Right.
Just from misidentifications. Yeah. And it's hard to know. But yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if there's somewhat over 200 species for Sitka. There are some groups that are notoriously difficult to identify, especially from photos. You might need to dissect them and look at their genitalia uh-huh. or something like
right.
that. So they are a number of tortricids. They're tortricidae. I think that's how you might pronounce it. They're Tortrix moths, I think, moths, they are some, like, for example, there's a fairly common species that is, at least in recent years, I think it goes through boom and bust cycles, but it's a Claris glovarianus. And it's something, I think its larval stage eats on hemlocks. And I've taken a number of pictures of those, at least four quite different looking forms of them. Mm-hmm. And some of them more distinct than others. But, you know, if I were just guessing based on what they look like from the pictures, I would say that those were different. But I've learned that they are all the same species and they're just different forms. And so sometimes you have that sort of thing going on where you have one species that has multiple forms. And other times you have two species that look very similar and can be very difficult to distinguish. So that is one of those things that, and that's true not just of insects, you know, but of plants and fungi and other things as well.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting puzzle though. And it's been fun to kind of see what's around and explore. And like I say, for me, the number aspect is somewhat motivating. And mm-hmm. This year I finally caught up on all my old observations. So I have a streak going, which is also motivating. I have the way in iNaturalist, you can look at your stats. And one of the stats that they keep track of is the number of new species added per month. But it's not when you observed them. It's when you uploaded them into the site. So okay. I have observed at least one new, or I have uploaded at least one new species into iNaturalist every month since sometime in 2016, or maybe it was even late 2015. Yeah. So I think I'm pretty much 5 years of every month, but a lot of that was because I was uploading old photos. And so I was getting the new species from all those old photos, especially in the wintertime. So now that I'm through with that, I'm like, all right, I got to be strategic about finding some new species each month this winter to keep my streak going. So
it's going to be challenging. Yeah, that's a good challenge.
Well, the good news is that really all it's going to take is me to be specific about some bryophytes and mm-hmm. some lichens, because there's plenty of those around that I don't have yet. And eventually, you know, or even intertidal stuff, you know, if I went down to the beach at night, I could almost certainly find things I haven't observed before. So it won't be so hard, but it will be motivating in a season that is otherwise, with the darkness and the rain, it's easy to hang around at home and you know, work on photos and inside stuff and not really do so much outside. So I like to use those as motivation for getting out. I'm not as kinetic as many people, so I don't feel driven to get out and move. It's easy for me to just stay in one place.
But you need more photos, so you gotta go. Yeah. No, that's great. And that's a great balance of it too, to be honest. You know, Sitka obviously is good for all of us to have some things we're passionate about that we can do indoors, because then you're going to be happy on these days. You know, when I was first here, I think I was pretty much almost entirely outdoor oriented. And so I felt more frustration maybe with these days, but with time I've developed interest both in iNaturalist and now mapping. I do best when it's rainy, when I need to sit at a computer. I can't sit at a computer in a sunny day. In fact, I don't put curtains on the window by my computer just so I can't use it when it's sunny. But there's a great balance in iNaturalist, you know, both the outdoor exploring, gathering the photos, the data, and then you process it on the dark, stormy nights. It's great. Good.
Well, you mentioned there that you've gotten into mapping, and I know that you have some maps that I've seen. You've kind of gone deep in GIS world with in more recent years with the landscape mapping, the LIDAR. I guess I don't know if it's imagery at that point. The LIDAR data that you can convert into imagery, and have been making some maps. So how'd you get into that? And it'd be interesting to hear a little bit about what you're doing with that.
Well, yeah, thanks for asking. And you know, it's very much tied to my interest in the outdoors. You know, I've been using maps since a young age, topo maps and others, to get around in the wilderness. Used a lot extensively, you know, with outdoor instructor type role. And then teaching, I've even been involved in teaching the Coast Guard navigation. So relying on maps, compass, GPS, all different levels, and just intuition. And I've always loved navigation. So this interest in maps has been a very strong one. And I remember, probably 40 years ago, thinking, I want to make a map someday. You know, I think I heard about someone making maps with GIS. GIS was very, very challenging to learn and use back then. And then in Sitka, a few years ago, maybe 4 years ago now, when Dan Evans and Eric Speck had done their end-to-end hiking of Baranoff Island, they had a big map on the wall, and the map was beautiful. And I went over and looked at the map, and I was, Dan, where did you get this map? And he pointed over to this fellow, Joshua Houston, in town. He works for the city now doing GIS work, and he's doing his own really cool projects with mapping with a drone. He got me started, and he just showed me some really quick tools, you know, where to find data and the software to use. You can get free software to run your GIS. You don't have to spend the big money on ArcGIS. He got me started, and I just started playing around with it, and I was just blown away by, as you say, in town, there's two types of data that we use a lot. It's called LIDAR data, and that's the laser pulse that they shoot from planes that yields highly accurate data. Around town, we have that. They shot that after our landslides to help us understand what's going on there. And it, basically now they have a new segment of it shot all the way up to Catlin Bay, which is great timing. I want to create a new map for that. That will include very detailed elevation data. So it typically LIDAR it can be more accurate, but every meter they're getting elevation data, you know, sub inch elevation data, but it also includes a second layer of the vegetation height or whatever structure you have, buildings, bridges, things like that. So you can build this 3D model showing trees, individual trees with LIDAR data. So that's my fun project around town of creating what I call slope shaded maps. And so I love getting off trail, and many other people do around town, whether it be hunting or berry picking or whatever. And it is very steep country. So I've done slope shaded maps, which will, you know, they're red where it's very steep, and yellow, orange, yellow, green, blue, you know, kind of shading. So you can pick what comfort level you have for steep terrain, and then you can find these routes, you know, going up Indian River Valley, up through steep areas. And I've found a few little benches up high that are good for hunting and just exploring. I really enjoy that process. So that's my Backcountry Explorers map, which I want to extend to Catlin Bay. And then my most challenging map was called the Sitka Surf and Turf map. And the idea was to build a map, you know, that's kind of designed for gathering of food, you know, deer, goats, I suppose, too, but also fishing. So I included all the bathymetric data for the ocean, and I colored the ocean, you know, it's depth related coloring. So deeper blues for deeper depths, and 10-foot contours. So you can really see this 3D imagery of the ocean with 10-foot contours. And it's made fishing a lot more fun. I feel like it's made it more productive for me. And then on land, I show things like landslides, clear cuts, vegetation. So you can hunt those edges that exist, you know, between muskeg and forest, and often more productive in deer. So these mapping projects are always extensions of my interest, I guess, for I want a map like that. So I create it, and then I make them available on Avenza on the side there. Been a real joy.
So if folks are interested, they can find it. Is it Avenza.com? You have to search for maybe your mapping company kind of name on that platform.
Yeah, I believe so. Avenza is an app that can go on your phone or Android or iPhone, and then you can search. And I guess you can search on a desktop too. I don't do a lot of this. I should know more. But yeah, it's Points North Maps is my company name. So you'd find them under that, or the Surf and Turf map, Sitka Surf and Turf. You can just look, you know, you can do an area search. So if you search our area, you'll find some topos. They used to have free, but there are still free maps. I don't think the NOAA charts are free anymore. I got a bunch of those way back when. And, you know, whenever you travel, you can see what's available for free there. And then there's other custom-made maps that cost a little bit. But I've enjoyed, you know, I mapped a part of Italy, Cinque Terre. When we were hiking there, it was a great place to hike along a coastline kind of like this, where there's all these villages hanging on cliffs. And they designed these villages with real 3D kind of stuff, with tunnels and stairs and bridges and lots of layering. So that was a different kind of technical challenge to layer all these maps. But it is fun. Again, it's like iNaturalist, where it involves computer work. But, you know, also when I'm staring at the computer with this really high resolution data, it's like, you know, when you're craning your neck out of a plane window, going over mountains, and I'm always dreaming of walking those ridges. Oh, where would I be in that? You know, so you can do that on the computer screen with this map detail and the 3D effects of it. It's pretty neat.
Yeah, it's funny for me. I mean, I don't do the mapping side of it. I have seen your maps, and certainly if folks are interested, would recommend they check them out. But the iNaturalist side of it, in some ways there's or just photos in general, as you know, not all the photos I take go on iNaturalist, because sometimes I'm taking pictures of peaks or ridges or scenery, mm-hmm. you know, but
right.
Just the looking at the pictures, sometimes there's the time I enjoy the hike most is thinking about having done it and doing it again.
Yeah.
And it's for me, it's long been that way. I noticed that, you know, 20 some years ago, that I was most excited about the hike, not while I was doing it, because sometimes while I was doing it, it wasn't much fun at all. It was uncomfortable and, you know, removed from the physical exertions and discomfort as a result of not being in as good a shape as I might like to be, or whatever, or the brush, yeah. or all of those things. Like, I really like talking about it, and I like, you know, thinking about it, looking at the pictures, remembering, anticipating the potential of going back again. And so it is funny how those things, I imagine it'd be similar with maps, where, you know, I have the topo maps of both Bear Knob and Chicago Island on my wall in my house, and, you know, look at them sometimes and like, oh, where would I want to go? And kind of imagining all those places and what they might be like. So it's kind of an interesting way to, yeah, connect the inside world and the world of the mind, so to speak, with the outdoor experience, and especially helpful on these winter days of darkness and rain, even when it is what counts for light here this time of year, or daylight, I should say.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, the maps of this area, it just reflects the beauty of this landscape and the complexity of it. So yeah, I can't help but inspire all this dream of getting out and, you know, so we have this time now to look at the maps and plan our next adventure. And that's the beauty of it, you know, it becomes this real motivational, go out and explore and have adventures. And it makes it rewarding to be doing that here.
Mm. Well, with that, I probably should wrap us up here. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we close?
Well, it's been great having the opportunity to share with you, Matt. And again, I really enjoy your show, and I really enjoy the natural world you're bringing to Sitkins through iNaturalist in this program. It's fun to get new ideas of things to explore and keep us going through times like this, especially.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Roland. Yeah, I appreciate your time here and your willingness to share. And I know there's lots of other stories we could share. Perhaps we'll visit again sometime for a future show. So thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Matt.
You've been listening to a conversation I recorded yesterday with Roland Wirth. I want to thank him for taking some time out of his day to visit with me. And thank you for joining me here on the Sitka Nature Show this week. As always, I'd love to hear what you're seeing out there. Please feel free to send me an email, sitkanature@gmail.com, or get on Facebook and like the Sitka Nature page there. You can also find recordings of past shows at sitkanature.org/raven. Until next time, this has been Matt on the Sitka Nature Show, KCAW, Sitka.